Welcome to Activation Energy by the Chemical Angel Network. I'm your host, Selma Duhovic. In this episode, Halima and I speak with Pavle Yuremich. Pavle graduated from UC Santa Cruz with a bachelor's in biomolecular engineering, after which he founded Ether Biomachines. Thanks so much for joining us, Pavle.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with your career trajectory. How did you get here?
Yeah, so I, in the synthetic biology space, I was very fortunate, basically early high school, to get an opportunity to start working at UC Davis doing synthetic biology research. You know, I often skip class just to go to lab and do this work. And so, you know, through that process, I became convinced that the way to build the future that I wanted to build was through synthetic biology, at least to start with. And so then I did my undergrad in astrophysics and bioengineering at UC Santa Cruz. I dropped out of astrophysics, finished bioengineering. And then from there, I just directly started the company and got to work. Early on, I was pipetting and writing code. Now I do a little bit less about those things, a lot more talking to people, but that's kind of my background.
What is the origin and inspiration for Ether Biomachines?
The origin story of Ether goes pretty far back. Our vision is to build a future of abundance for the human race. I've been obsessed with some version of that problem my entire life, and it comes from my background. So my parents fled Yugoslavia when the Civil War broke out in the early 90s. I was born in the United States while my parents were pursuing PhDs and being grad students, couldn't really afford daycare. So I had this unusual childhood where part of the year I was raised by my parents in the US, part of the year I was raised by my grandparents in former Yugoslavia, whatever country it was that month or that year. And I grew up in these two worlds where in the US, everything, you know, we didn't have a lot of money, but university towns are pretty nice. And in whatever country it was that month or that year in the Balkans, it was an active war zone. And every time I came back, there were new bombed out buildings. And that dichotomy growing up left an obsession that I've had for as long as I can remember with understanding why does this dichotomy exist in the world and how do I make it so it never exists again. I read a lot of history and science fiction. And when I was reading the history of our species, it occurred to me, and it's not a unique idea, other people have come to the same conclusion, but it occurred to me that if you look at the history of our species, the primary driver of human suffering is scarcity. And it's not just the obvious, if your food is scarce, you suffer. It's a more subtle driver, which is parents will do anything to provide for their children if they get desperate enough. And so historically, when enough people get desperate enough, really bad things happen very quickly there afterwards. That's usually when edge case human behavior kind of becomes the mean, and that's usually not a good thing. So how do you build a world where that sort of desperation is incredibly difficult to achieve or almost impossible? And you won't solve every problem the human race has, but you will, I think, make a much more stable, much more peaceful and productive world where a lot of this shit doesn't happen anymore, basically. So I couldn't figure out how you could actually build this. It's kind of a significant thing to build. I also became convinced at a young age that this was the solution to this problem, to build this future of abundance with some kind of nanotechnology, because you're talking about increasing the industrial productivity of the human race by probably 1 to 2 orders of magnitude. And to do that would require a manufacturing technology that's dramatically more scalable and efficient than anything that's developed by the human race. And so naturally I sort of looked at, is nanotechnology of some version of that solution? But again, easier said than done. And finally, when I began to work at UC Davis in high school doing synthetic biology research, that was really when I realized that nature had evolved machinery at the nanoscale that looked like the nanotechnology I want to build. Now, to be clear, long-term, that's not the solution. But the best starting point I have are protein-based nanomachines, right? There's nothing else that exists that's even remotely comparable to nanoscale technology like that. So Ether basically is a company that says, how can we, using high-throughput robotics, machine learning, and chemical engineering, get incredibly good at engineering small protein-based machines to rearrange atoms programmatically, so either binding to atoms and desolubilizing them or making or breaking chemical bonds, do so in a way where that capability is so generalizable that we can start to build more complex components at the nanoscale and start building the second generation of nanotechnology based off of that, where the first is sort of this protein-based nanotech. And, you know, so far, so good. It's definitely much harder than I thought it would be.
Can you elaborate on what it is that you have developed and are commercializing?
The proteins that we engineer are engineered to catalyze new types of chemical reactions, and we build products based off of those chemical reactions. The two lead products right now are our lithium program, where we are building an extraction technology to extract effectively any metal, but we're starting with lithium as our first target. And we have a secondary program in the material space where we've created a new class of polymer that we can blend with other polymers and get significant changes to material properties through that. But I'll go step by step. On the lithium side, the proteins we've engineered, you can think of them as almost like tiny mouse traps that when they bump against a lithium atom, for example, or whatever atom we program them to bind to, the protein snaps and captures that atom. And we can build a process, this sort of an end-to-end process, where you can take, for example, water from deep underground that has lithium in it, pump it up, pump it through the system, and then push it through filters that have our little protein or lithium binding mass traps embedded on that filter. And as the lithium flows past, it gets stuck in those proteins. And then we can program them to release the lithium later. There's several ways we can do that. That's our mining technology that we're developing. That's going quite well. And then on the material side, we've developed as a new class of polymer where it can change its material properties depending on the temperature. And in particular, it can start to polymerize at certain temperatures. And what that means is that when you look at 3D printing, it's a great example of this. When you print layer after layer in 3D printing, what our additive does is it polymerizes across the gap between the layers. So it removes strength deficiencies that are created by the 3D printing process. And has a few other benefits like improving ultimate tensile strength and all that kind of stuff. So you could almost think of this secondary polymer we've developed as a sort of self-healing polymer because it intentionally polymerizes across gaps and sort of seals the material. In both of these situations, we've built out the product and chemistry teams to do the end-to-end product testing. That's been something that's incredibly important and a real learning over the last year. And so we are going everywhere from protein engineering to product development on the back end.
So what is unique and better about this technology?
Let's talk about how the tech on the platform side is unique and differentiated, and then we can talk about the products and why they're unique and differentiated. On the platform side, the core concept behind Aether's platform technology is this idea called indexing. We try to build data sets where we robustly map different protein designs to many different functionalities. And those functionalities are chemical reactions that are catalyzed or not catalyzed. So there's obviously a very large number of possible functionalities for protein. And a hypothesis we had early on that we've since proven out is that it's less important to test many different protein designs because proteins share a lot in common with each other. There's a lot of similar structural motifs. They all work in very similar ways. But each protein can have many different functionalities. And that's been a significant learning over the last 20 years in the industry. People used to think one enzyme, one chemical reaction, and it was a perfect match and it would only ever do that chemical reaction. That's not true. There are a lot of unexpected chemical reactions that enzymes can catalyze that people are just not aware of. And so given that that's the case, we decided to test, to build a technology, a platform, a robotic system that could test each of these enzymes against many different potential chemical reactions in parallel. So that when we build this data set and we label what the protein does or does not do, it's a comprehensive labeling of this protein does these 16 different chemical reactions and does not do these other 300 whatever chemical reactions. And what we've found is that when you generate those types of data sets and train machine learning models off of it, they are able to extrapolate to new types of chemical reactions that people haven't seen before. And that really, when you think about the differentiation of the platform, and this also drives differentiation of our products, it's really that core concept that all other synthetic biology companies tend to be fairly limited to chemical reactions that look very similar to what exists in nature. And this is why people spend so much time looking at sequencing everything in the wild and trying to find as many sequences as possible, because they're sort of harvesting what nature has already evolved and trying to find interesting catalysts from what nature has already evolved. We do not need that. We are able to use our data sets to design proteins that execute new functionalities, even if we've never seen that functionality before. I mean, a good example is our lithium binding peptides. There aren't really lithium binding proteins out there in nature because lithium isn't really biologically relevant, except for its weird antidepressant effects that I don't think anyone really understands how that works. We were able to engineer lithium binding peptides. Similar thing for these polymers. These polymers don't exist in nature. In fact, the polymerization chemistry doesn't exist in nature. We were able to design an enzyme that could polymerize it. And that drives the differentiation of our products, because if you ignore the word enzyme and all the biological aspects of what Aether does, what Aether is really doing is designing new types of catalysts that haven't existed before. And so when we build our products, we try to find markets and applications where a new catalysis that doesn't yet exist, if it did exist, would enable a significantly differentiated suite of products on top of it. Just this chemical reaction can happen. We can make these products that people have always wanted to make. And that goes to a really fundamental bet of the company, which is we don't build products that can be made using existing chemistries for the most part. And obviously that's sort of a, it's never black and white, but, and we try not to do that because if we're making a product that's possible using that can be made using traditional synthetic chemistry routes, the bet that we're making is we're smarter than 10,000 chemists that work at DuPont. And that's not a great bet. There's a lot of very smart people that work at these companies. They've probably tried to make the product that we're trying to make right now. And I bet a lot of money on that. Instead, we'd love to be making products that 10,000 chemists at DuPont have been dreaming of for decades, but could never figure out how to make in the first place. That's sort of our sweet spot. That's where we think we'll be the most differentiated long-term. So on the lithium side, this technology allows lithium extraction from deposits that are not accessible today because of the incredibly high selectivity of these peptides to lithium, for example, over other metals. On the polymer side, properties that we're enabling here are not supposed to be possible. I was told by the head of product at one of the larger plastics companies that it should not be possible for us to do what we are now able to do. And so a lot more work to do to bring these products to market. And really, you know, I'll say we're truly differentiated once we have customers buying our products. But that is how we've built the technology to date.
You touched base on this, but what are two or three examples of the complex and novel products that your platform is capable of manufacturing?
Yeah, great question. So on the mineral side, as far as we can tell, this technology should work for any metal that we target. Now, I'm sure there will be complications when you look at the more radioactive elements and all that kind of stuff, or stuff like arsenic, but or iodine. But this should generalize to most metals as long as the metal isn't going to damage a peptide backbone in some way. The other class of products, you know, we have a PFAS degradation product that's quite interesting, enzymes that bind and either degrade or desolubilize PFAS molecules at room temperature. We have our enzymes that create this new class of polymer that isn't really possible before, and they don't just make linear polymers, they make more complex topologies than that, which is, leads to some very interesting material properties, it turns out. And you know, we've even had partnerships with pharma companies where we developed a new class of hydrolase that basically degraded the wrong, they were synthesizing a drug where there was a right and left-handed form of the drug. And the way they did the synthesis, it was almost one pot, so all of it was made at once. So they were making twice as much stuff, can only use half of it for the drug. We designed a new class of hydrolase that actually degraded the incorrect one early in the synthesis. And so it just drove the reaction to the chiral form that was correct. So we've done this a few times now. And I think one of the big learnings that we've had over the last couple of years is, you know, we've gotten pretty good at the designing totally new classes of protein problem. That's, and obviously there's, it's some are easy, some are hard, but we're getting pretty good at that. The capability we're building on now is how do you take those proteins and in certain verticals, build a process and a team and expertise to build end-to-end products. So right now we're doing that in materials and minerals. So now we have teams where, hey, interesting protein, interesting polymer X. Within a couple of weeks, we can be testing large scale what that polymer does, and we can feed that information back and say, actually, we need this polymer, not that polymer, or we need the synthesis to be this efficient. That's a capability that is actually almost done being built out. It's quite exciting.
So why is this technology important? Can you describe the potential impact on society, both people and the planet?
The reason why this technology matters is because when you look at traditional chemical manufacturing and traditional chemical synthesis, let me put it that way, it's a stochastic process. And what that means is we are creating conditions where we try to drive these molecules to bump into each other at just the right angle, but it's fundamentally driven by randomness. We just try to drive the reaction towards what we want it to do. We're imagining a future where the manufacturing of complex products down from the pharmaceutical level to even larger products than that is not driven by randomness, but it's driven by mechanical systems that grab atoms and molecules and just staple them together, almost like assembly lines at the nanoscale. And what that means is that you start to imagine a future where not only the efficiency of your manufacturing grows by many orders of magnitude, but the scalability in terms of capital grows as well, where rather than having a $500 million pharmaceutical plant to manufacture HIV drugs in sub-Saharan Africa, which obviously they're not doing because there's no way they'll ever recover the investment from a $500 million plant in those three parts of the world. You're talking about a $5 million shipping container size plant that can, using these nanoscale protein-based machines, stitch together all the right atoms in the right arrangements to produce the drug on the back end, do so at orders of magnitude lower cost. So it's a future where industrial growth can be accelerated dramatically because of the lower operating capital costs. And it's done so in a way where, because of the higher efficiency, the impact to the planet is negligible. Same thing for mining.
And how do you make money from this?
Yeah, there's been several models we've tried. We are a product company at the end of the day. And so our goal is to either directly sell products to end users and customers. And so, for example, that's what we're doing on the material side, or potentially license the final product to an end user as well. So, on the lithium side, for example, we are in talks in the United States to directly provide battery grade lithium to some buyers. And then we're in talks internationally to license to some international areas and say, hey, you can just use this technology within this field of exclusivity and pay us a percentage on the back end. But it's us developing products and then finding buyers for it, either directly through sales or through licensing deals. The assumption in all of our plans is that we'll have to push it through directly to sales, mostly because, look, if you get someone that gives you great licensing terms, that's the cherry on top of the cake, right? It's great. But don't bet that that's what's going to happen. And I think that that's been a failure mode of a lot of synthetic biology companies, where they hope that they don't have to take the product fully to market themselves and that they'll license it to someone else who will take it to product to market themselves. And the problem with that strategy fundamentally is, let's say you sign a licensing deal with giant company X, for example. To you as a startup, it is your number one priority that this licensing deal goes through and that they commercialize and you get revenue from it. To giant company X, your product is probably number 15 on their priority list. And that's going to be reflected in the timelines, how much they delay stuff, and how quickly they're able to actually start generating revenue. So, it's a bit of a trap that you can fall into. And look, great if you can find an awesome deal and you can incentivize commercialization, that's awesome, but don't bet on it.
You mentioned in the beginning that you tried multiple monetization strategies. Can you describe one strategy that failed and the lessons that you learned from that failure?
Absolutely. So there's been a lot of iterations on what the right business model is. And there's been interesting learnings along the way that have gotten us to where we are today. So early on, the problem we were trying to solve was to say, hey, we don't know how much data it's going to take to engineer new types of chemistry, because no one's really done this before, except for like a few PhD theses coming out of a couple labs in the United States. But like, how much data is it actually going to take to train models to robustly engineer new chemistries? We didn't know. So we tried to figure out, how do we find contracts and deals where we get paid to generate data and we can provide value to someone on the back end as well, but we're able to kind of build up our data sets. So we initially tried a fee-for-service model where we basically worked with pharma companies and we said, hey, what is a synthesis problem you have that we could engineer a catalyst or an enzyme for, some new synthesis that they haven't seen before? And the problem with that approach was twofold. The first was, it's very hard to figure out how to do data sharing in those markets. Even if the synthesis is not fundamental to the drug's mechanism of action, companies in that space tend to be very reticent to share them or to allow you to kind of use that data for other applications. We were able to solve that. But the other fundamental problem was, manufacturing is just not a huge problem for most drugs, right? If it's an on-patent drug, they can charge whatever they want. So lowering the cost of manufacturing is not a huge priority for them. I mean, it's a nice to have, effectively, which is not a great place to be as a startup providing a nice to have. And the generic side, where manufacturing cost does matter, this is an industry that makes its entire margins off of like half a cent savings per dollar. It is very hard to get them to share the value on the back end if you're able to lower their manufacturing costs, because the margins are just so tight for them. And the thing that we actually learned through that process, we said, well, wait a second, we found this new chemistry for our pharma partner very quickly. I think it took under 5 months to find the chemistry. Most of that was just setting up the platform. And, when we looked at the data that we were generating, the reason why I thought it would take a long time to build data sets to train these machine learning models is, I thought when we generated these indexes, which you can kind of think as a heat map of enzymes on one dimension and different possible chemical reactions on the other dimension, and like the heat map is just which enzymes catalyze which reaction, I thought that that was going to be a very sparse mapping. So I thought that, on average, an enzyme tested against 300 chemicals, maybe it would catalyze an interesting chemical reaction on like 5 or 6 of them. That wasn't true at all. So there's an enormous amount of diversity, even in just natural enzymes, in terms of chemical reactions that they can or can't catalyze that no one else knows about. So once we had those two learnings, we realized that we did not need to wait to find a way for other people to generate our data, or for other people to pay us to generate data. And we could get to work on the products that we wanted to work on now. So then it was just a question of, what are the right markets to build those products in the first place? But that was really the big learning, is that fee-for-service, especially in very technical businesses. I mean, fee-for-service is totally fine if it's a software play and the cost of actually deploying the product and the complexity is low. But when you're talking about extremely complex catalyst design and engineering, fee-for-service is a very difficult business model to make work. And there's very few niches where it makes sense.
I very much agree with that. Conversion of fee-for-service pilot or POC projects to full commercial contracts is really, really tough. I'm wondering if you can describe the market segments that you're targeting and the traction that you have across each one.
Absolutely. So we've generated revenue from other partnerships in the past, but the two main products right now on the material side, we have multiple defense-related customers in Europe primarily that are entering qualification with our material. Now, I can't give you more details than that. Those are confidential arrangements, but they are NATO and NATO allied military. And so it's entering the qualification process, which means our product is being field tested actually as we speak, most likely. Well, what time is it over there? Yeah, it's probably being field tested as we speak. So that's very exciting. The qualification process will take a certain amount of time. It just depends on the exact application. And from there, those will flip into sales contracts if our product behaves as we expect it to behave. On the lithium side, we are more likely to sign a contract towards the end of this year. And that's just because we need to actually build and deploy a pilot in the field for lithium. That's the major value inflection point for lithium is, did we put our interesting proteins in a filter system, put together an entire process, all the pumps and everything else that you need, and put it in the field and show that we can actually extract battery grade lithium from these currently inaccessible deposits for a sustained amount of time. The first pilot should be deployed relatively soon, and we'll start gathering data, and then we'll build a bigger pilot and then kind of keep building up from there.
So what is the opportunity worth if you succeed in executing your plans?
Yeah. So for the first two products, the lithium market is probably a single digit billions of dollars opportunity for the full market size. We expect to take a significant percentage of that because in the near term, we will be one of the fastest growing providers of battery grade lithium in the US. And so there's a lot of benefits from the IRA and all these other acts that incentivize domestic battery grade manufacturing. Long term, the reason why we'll win in the lithium space is because we suspect, if the technology works the way we think it will, that our both CapEx and OpEx costs are going to be dramatically lower than anyone else. And so we will be able to very rapidly grow manufacturing capacity, and we will be able to survive as we continuously drive down lithium price. Because really, that's the goal for Aether with lithium is we're not in the lithium business because we want lithium to be $30,000 a ton. We want lithium to be $5,000 a ton in the deep future. And we're going to drive it to that point because that's going to drive the electrification of the human race. There's obviously similar sized opportunities in other metals, but we don't have to talk about that because that's not a product we're on immediately. In the material space, at least for our initial set of additives in the 3D printing space, we think the opportunity is more in the hundreds of millions of dollars range, something that we can access. And that's primarily driven by the fact that 3D printing is not that big of a market overall, but it's a fast adopting market. However, the same additives that we've developed, this new polymer additive class, it works for even if you use the plastic in injection molding, which is obviously a much larger market. And that's where you probably end up back in the billions of dollars range in terms of market size.
And what will it take to capture the value that you create and actually seize a fraction of these multi-billion dollar opportunities?
More funding at some point. It's a good question. So they're different for the two different products, which is kind of interesting. So what's interesting about the materials product we've developed so far is that the synthesis is sufficiently typical. It's using the same non-aqueous solvents that everyone else uses. It's just using our enzymes that we're able to get CMOs or contract manufacturers to manufacture it for us. And so the materials business is an opportunity to potentially be self-sustaining fairly quickly. I would say within like 2 years after first commercialization, right? Because the scale up of CMOs does take time. On the lithium side, if the tech works the way we expect it to work, and again, we haven't deployed the pilot in the field, so entirely possible we run into issues. In fact, I would bet that we run into issues, right? It's hard. The technology we're building, that's where the significant capital needs are really going to come in, because then we're going to want to start building more of these shipping container size extractor systems as quickly as humanly possible and deploying them across the United States and eventually globally. So, you know, you're looking at tens of millions of dollars of capital requirement, multiple tens of millions of dollars of capital requirements for that program specifically, and similar requirements for future programs on top of that. But really medium term, so I would say in the next 5 years, not in the next two, the goal is really, as we sort of test, you know, today what we're doing is we're really testing the first generation of these shipping container size manufacturing plants that I talk about. And some of them are being used to extract lithium and some of them are being used to manufacture new types of polymers. As we figure out how to build those, you know, in 5 years' time, we'd really want to build a factory that just builds these smaller shipping container size factories. So you can almost imagine a facility where just sheet metal and protein goes in on one side, and out the other end comes shipping container size systems that are extremely efficient at making the products we care about, and we just ship them across the world. That's really the goal with this push. And, you know, ideally 5 years from now, that's what we're building, but maybe it'll take a little longer than that.
Can you talk about the challenges that you've had to overcome up to this point, and also the risks that you foresee moving forward?
Oh my God, there's so many challenges. I forget about them. There's like a crazy number, which actually, I mean, I feel like this is not exactly your question, but I think it's just such an important point that I try to make as often as I can. I don't think there's much similar between most successful founders. There's a lot of differences between them as people. They're enormously different people in a lot of cases. The only consistency is persistence. And I'm not claiming I'm a successful founder yet. You know, talk to me in 2 years once I have actual lithium extractors, and then we can have that discussion. But there's a lot of challenges. I mean, what we're doing is hard, right? It is a difficult thing to build. This is deep tech on multiple levels. We're doing next generation protein engineering, next generation chemical engineering. We're trying to staple them together and get them to work in the middle of the Texan desert. So it's been a lot of things that we've had to overcome and figure out to get here. And there's going to be many more things to overcome in the future. When you think about specific tangible risks moving forward, not just a sort of philosophical diatribe, on the lithium side, I think the biggest risk right now is the unknown unknowns on field deployment. Because we can do all this amazing work, and the team really is doing amazing work in the lab, testing all these different columns, all these different protein combinations and formulations. We're getting really exciting results. But the fundamental truth is that you're not really going to know until you put a box in the field for 3 months and you find out, oh, wow, calcium buildup in some of these pumps is absolutely going to kill you, and we have to redesign the entire system. That's the risk on the lithium side, and that is why we are pushing as hard as possible to start field testing as soon as possible, because that's the only way you're going to address that risk. You cannot know in advance all of the potential unknown unknowns, almost by definition. On the material side, the biggest risk is market segment, actually. So what's interesting about this, and these balance each other well, right? So there isn't really scientific risk anymore on the lithium program because we now have demonstrated that it's possible to bind to lithium and that we can improve the selectivity. So it's a process, but that's gone. It's more engineering risk of, can we put all these parts together in a way that works, is stable, and makes sense economically? On the material side, the engineering risk is fairly low. The synthesis is pretty scalable. We're already seeing dramatic changes to bulk properties. And yes, we're gonna have to do more formulation work, but like, it's working. The risk is market risk. And specifically, I say that because when you look at the materials market in general, however, whatever tens or hundreds of billions of dollars you want to value it at, it's not really one market. It's thousands of different subsegments, all with very specific requirements they have and very specific, you know, qualification timelines and purchasing timelines. And so the easiest way to die with the materials product is not to have a crappy material. Like, you could have a great material and be in the wrong niche. There's an example of a competitor's material. They tried to commercialize one niche, it totally failed. And I have been told by the head of manufacturing at a very large car company that they found a completely different application for that material that they would love, but that company is bankrupt now, so no one can synthesize the material. So the car company is like, well, we're not chemists, so whatever, we're just gonna move on. So it's the way to redress that risk is just get samples in customers' hands. Just like, we have people working around the clock, scaling up synthesis, getting kilos out, and just getting samples in customers' hands as quickly as possible.
So, in summary, unknown unknowns, which in my mind is just another term for ignorance, is a big risk that you're facing. Yes, ignorance is very much present in early stage startups, especially those with first-time founders. And I will say that I very much appreciate that you're humble enough to be aware of that. Last question, what is your ultimate vision for Aether Biomachines?
So the ultimate vision for Aether is really a company that is able to decentralize and democratize, not the quite the right word, but massively decentralize the manufacturing of most essential products on this planet in these super scalable, super cheap shipping container size systems that can just be set up everywhere. So, you know, everything from eliminating the HIV problem in sub-Saharan Africa, because we can make HIV drugs at incredibly low cost everywhere in sub-Saharan Africa. So they're just readily available. And there's obviously public policy to solve that as well, but public policy won't work if the drugs aren't there, to enabling the next generation of materials and fundamentally molecular products that people couldn't even imagine 10, 20 years ago that we're enabling at that point, and doing all of this at levels of efficiency that almost eliminate the environmental impact. So rather than strip mining to get lithium or cobalt or whatever metal you want, all we're doing is pulling water out of the ground that has the metal we care about, stripping the metal out, and then pushing the water right back down. So just the metal's gone and everything else is exactly the same. This is really the vision, this world of incredibly accelerated industrial growth based off the production of new products at low cost everywhere on the planet, accessible to every human being.
Great. Thank you so much again for coming on the show, Pavle.
Thanks for having me, Selma.